This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in today for Terry Gross. You might remember our guest, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Venman, from the 2019 impeachment hearings involving then-President Donald Trump's dealings with Ukraine. Venman was on the staff of the National Security Council when he listened to the president's now famous call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. After hearing it, Venman reported to officials in the Security Council his concern about Trump seeking an investigation of Joe Biden's son from the Ukrainian president after Zelensky had asked for promised U.S. military assistance. That landed Venman in the middle of the impeachment inquiry and in front of Congress, where he testified twice, once behind closed doors and once publicly. Venman has family roots in Ukraine. When he was just 3 years old, his father brought him and his two brothers to the United States from the Soviet Union. All three sons would pursue military careers. When Venman testified before Congress, he referred to his history and to his father in his opening statement.
I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions, and offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.
That's Alexander Venman in his testimony before Congress. Venman wasn't exactly fine after he told the truth. After Trump was acquitted in the Senate, Venman was fired from the National Security Council, and his promised promotion to full colonel was effectively blocked, leading to his retirement from the Army. Alexander Venman has written a new memoir. It's called Here, Right Matters, An American Story. Alexander Venman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. I'm so looking forward to this conversation.
You know, it was interesting that you addressed your dad in your opening testimony. You said you'll be okay for telling the truth. What did your father think of your reporting what you saw and heard and telling your story to Congress?
I recognized early on what my dad's fears were. They were fears over what would happen to me personally, what could happen to the family. Those fears were rooted in 47 years of living under the Soviet regime. And those fears went everything from the end of a career to potentially the loss of life. So I think when my dad counseled me not to go up against the president of the United States, he was channeling that. There were some thoughts about whether, you know, it was because he was a Trump supporter. Yes, earlier on when he didn't really understand the full implications of what Trump had done, as a Trump supporter, he may have had some thoughts about, like, well, this couldn't be right. But certainly as he learned the facts, those weren't his fears. His fears were going up against power, going up against the most powerful man in the world. And that's where his counsel was coming from, a place of love and concern for his children.
You know, we'll talk in a bit about what happened once you testified publicly and how Trump's supporters attacked you. As those attacks mounted, did it change your father's thinking at all?
You know, when I first spoke to him in those closing days of September, and all there was a whistleblower complaint, he couldn't really quite understand, you know, what the president had done wrong. And I wasn't at liberty to really go into details because documents were still classified. Most of this was not in the public sphere. But as soon as facts began to come to light, including the president's corruption and undermining the very foundation of our democracy, which is free and fair elections and ultimately the peaceful transfer of power, my dad recognized, you know, what he was seeing. He could easily detect the hallmarks of authoritarianism. And frankly, he took a more critical eye. He stopped listening to Fox News. he started listening to other news media sources, and it was almost like a light was shined on this matter. And my dad was a microcosm of, I think, of a subset of American population that really took a keen interest in the impeachment and understood how corrupt it was.
So you were the National Security Council director for Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Russia, which meant that you were intimately involved with implementing U.S. policy on Ukraine. Before we talk about the phone call, just give us the context in a nutshell. What was going on with Ukraine policy at the time, which caused such concern to you?
Sure. So preceding the July 25th phone call, there were months and months of what I've referred to as stray voltage into policy. So these are non-governmental actors, the president's personal representatives, drawing Ukraine into domestic politics. That first came to the public's attention with the removal of Ambassador Yovanovitch, and ultimately it became, and I was working these issues on a day-to-day basis, but there was a hold on security assistance. I had monitored this all the way through, recognizing increasingly closer links to the president.
Just to clarify that one point, this security assistance, this is money for defensive weapons that were approved by Congress that the White House mysteriously had placed on hold, right?
These are appropriated funds that the executive branch was legally obligated to spend in the way they were directed.
Let's talk about the phone call. Just describe the setting, where you were when you heard the call, who else was there?
Sure. So it's a room that I had been in, you know, dozens of times at that point. I was on staff for a year. I held countless meetings and participated in countless meetings in that room. It's a, room in the basement of the West Wing. There were half a dozen officials or so in the room, and then some parties that were on other lines. The president took it from his residence, like he did most things that early in the morning. And turns out that, Secretary Pompeo was online. John Bolton was not on the line. I think he was savvy enough to not be on that phone call, even though he made it a point to participate in general.
Right. He's the National Security Advisor at the time. Now, you had prepared talking points for the president for this because of your role. What can you tell us about them?
Sure. So one of the responsibilities of the director is to set up these phone calls and prepare the president of the United States to execute these phone calls. This was a relatively perfunctory congratulatory call. The president had executed a similar phone call just months before when President Zelensky won his election. And the gist of it was to congratulate President Zelensky on his new political party, the Servants of the People Party, winning an unprecedented majority in the Ukrainian parliament called the Rada. And in addition to that, reinforce the fact that we expect progress on reforms, anti-corruption agenda, and we look forward to cooperating in certain areas. And that was really the crux of what the phone call should have been.
So you listened to the president, and you noticed right away something about his kind of tone and mood. What was it?
Yeah, absolutely. In the first phone call that I had listened to, he was ebullient. He likes winners. He likes to be surrounded by winners. He was congratulatory, as you would imagine. He was, in good spirits. And this was 180 degrees opposite. He was reluctant. He was monotone. He was low energy. And you could tell that this was not going to be the typical kind of congratulatory phone call where you're offering encouragement to the person that you're speaking to. And that was even before, anything substantive transpired in the phone call.
So you have the president on there. He sounds kind of low energy, a little grumpy, I gather from your description. President Zelensky is a former comedian, and it's interesting because others are relying on the translation. You are fluent in Ukrainian. What was your sense of what Zelensky was trying to do in this call?
Well, so Zelensky was being charismatic, engaging, complimentary. The way you would imagine a comedian looking to engage with kind of an audience and looking for different inroads to bring the president around. The whole idea for Zelensky was to try to get a meeting at the White House. And he was also clearly prepared for that phone call. Some of the things that he said, including offering up the word Burisma, indicated that there was some coordination behind the scenes and that he knew what he had to deliver for the president. And
that's the company that Hunter Biden had been on the board of before, right? the gas company.
That's correct. And I think, Zelensky, he was criticized for it. He'll probably get additional criticism. But frankly, he did what he needed to do to protect his country that was facing really existential crisis, continues to face an existential crisis with regard to Russia and Russian aggression. And he was doing it in the most high, what I consider to be kind of a high-minded manner. If there is something to this matter, the Ukrainians would investigate it. They would do it transparently. They would do it honestly, you know, transfer to us what we have. So there's a proper process for this that he was trying to fall back on. But the president, you know, had no idea what the process was. And all he was doing is putting the squeeze on, you know, in response to Zelensky's ask for additional javelins, anti-tank systems required to resist a future Russian attack. That's when the president came in with, I need you to do us a favor, though. So the whole thing was geared towards this squeezing out a demand for an investigation.
And so what was your immediate reaction when you heard this? I need you to do us a favor.
I just continued to take notes. I mean, I don't think I necessarily did it for posterity. I always take a large number of notes, but maybe there was in the back of my mind, make sure everything is accurate, make sure I have a good kind of record of what was said, and listen through the rest of the phone call. We kind of mulled over the press release that had drafted ahead of time that had to be completely revised because most of the issues were not addressed. And then I just went straight to the proper officials at the National Security Council, the senior legal officials, assistants to the president, the highest ranked officers in the White House, and reported to them what I had heard.
I mean, you wanted to report this, and you first went to the chief ethics officer for the National Security Council, and that was whom?
Well, the chief ethics officer was my twin brother, which, you know, how wonderful is it to work in the same building in the same office as your twin brother? But we have conversations on a daily basis, multiple times a day. We commuted in and out. And I wanted him to be aware of this as I took it, you know, to his leadership so that I had a witness, somebody else that was there to corroborate my report.
So the two of you went together, these two identical twins, to John Eisenberg, who was the senior attorney for the National Security Council, right?
Right. And John Eisenberg was fairly well filled in on what was going on based on my previous concerns. And my intent was simply to get him to counsel the president, who he interacted with on a regular basis, that this was illegal, this would a smack of corruption, and to get the president, like he had so like had happened so many times in the administration, to reverse course on an ill-advised tweet or pronouncement, but he would change his mind constantly, which is not really well known publicly. He refuses to change his position, but behind the scenes, he'll change his mind depending on the way the wind blew, and that's kind of what I had going in my mind. That, you know, we could get the president to reverse course on this and get what had been the entirety of the interagency, the entirety of the U.S. government, the consensus to have a strong relationship with Ukraine back on track.
Let's talk a bit about your background. You were born in Ukraine, then in the Soviet Union, to a Jewish family. Just tell us a little bit about your family history, particularly your grandparents.
Sure. So I was born in 1975. My father's generation lived through World War II. His father perished in the war, so did my mother's father, my biological mother's father. She passed away when I was about 3 years old or so. And our roots in Ukraine go back decades and decades, at least to the middle of the 19th century.
Back in the Soviet Union, what did your father do? He had a successful career, didn't he?
He did have a very successful career. He was a civil engineer responsible for some of the largest projects in the capital city, Kiev, stadiums, massive housing complexes, roads, tunnels, dams, all sorts of stuff. And he was one of the senior most officials in the kind of the engineering bureau, a member of the Communist Party, for most of his adult life until he broke with the party.
This was a time when there were opportunities for Jews to emigrate from the Soviet Union. Your dad, despite his success and privilege in the Soviet society, decided to do it. Do you have a feeling for why?
I certainly do. I mean, a key driver would have been the fact that my mother was dying of cancer, and my father had, not too long before that, heard about the treatment for this particular kind of cancer in the United States. And then, more importantly, is his disillusionment with the communist system, its corruption, and the fact that there was a high degree of anti-Semitism that was institutionalized, and that we would not have the same kind of opportunities he had. And all of these things came together to get him to start something completely different.
You describe serving in Korea and building your skills as a leader, learning in training exercises and war games how to think creatively with your battlefield assets and growing as a commander. Then the Iraq invasion happens. You are deployed to Iraq and were there at Fallujah when you were injured. You went on and studied a lot more of military tactics. The chapter that includes your combat experience is titled The Moral Compass. And you say essentially that the courage that you had years later in 2019 to stand up and do the right thing in the National Security Council when it wasn't easy and it certainly involved risk, that you got some of that from your experience in battle, that sense of right and wrong, the moral compass. Help us understand that. What's the connection here?
So I think there's a clear recognition about how high the stakes are. I mean, our country has been at war for two decades, and many people sacrificed their lives for this country. I mean, I'm not even getting into the political aspect of it. Whether it was right or wrong, people died serving this nation. And that is the ultimate sacrifice. There's obviously a beautiful quote by The Last Measure of Devotion from Lincoln's speech. And that's just such an amazing line that resonates with me, probably resonates with a lot of service members, people that have served in combat. It seemed like a small price to pay to continue to do your duty when you're not in a combat zone, when the stakes in certain regards are much lower from the personal level. You know, I was not going to get killed. My risks were to my career, maybe my livelihood, maybe, some harassment and things of that nature. But in the big scheme of things, I thought it was a small price to pay. And, how far are you willing to go to defend your nation? I served 20 years in uniform. I was not going to let myself bend and be weak-kneed on this occasion when I saw our democracy under threat.
So after the July 25th phone call, when you were so disturbed at what you saw, and you and your brother Eugene, who was the ethics officer for the National Security Council, went to John Eisenberg, the senior attorney for the National Security Council, with something that certainly seemed like explosive information, how did he handle it?
Well, John is a pretty savvy individual, cautious, and basically took down my report, asked a few questions on whether I thought, this was criminal behavior. I said I didn't have the kind of training to determine that, but I was deeply concerned by it. And frankly, we left it there for some time. He'd periodically check on me, kind of like managing, making sure I didn't go off the reservation. But that's where things stayed or seemed to stay for me, minus the couple of folks I had to engage with just to make sure that they were tracking, the substance of the phone call, the same thing that any director would do for any normal phone call, to kind of read folks in on the relevant points, kind of not all the details, but the relevant points. And days later, I was told not to talk to anybody else about it, about this phone call.
Yeah, what did that tell you?
It told me that, it was more than just don't talk to anybody else. It was, we received an inquiry from the inspector general from the CIA about this matter. Somebody expressed some concerns about it. And then the CIA IG went back to John Eisenberg. A little bit of a flaw that, that IG from a department agency took a concern about the White House back to the White House. So that didn't, in hindsight, that didn't help me as a potential whistleblower, because now I was going to be scrutinized even more carefully. But I knew that there was an awareness. There seemed to be an awareness about my participation and how that resulted in kind of a fact that they would hope would not become not public, but would be held in a very, very close circle, in a ever-increasing circle of folks that understood that there was a corrupt phone call, and they were looking to minimize that.
We're going to take another break here. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Alexander Vindman. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. His memoir about his experience in the events that led to President Trump's first impeachment is called Here, Right Matters, An American Story. We'll talk more after this short break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. That strange sound you heard on our last show was live people laughing and applauding. Be a part of our next show with real live people on August 26th at Tanglewood. Join us live and you too can finally see what our real live legs look like. Legs. Remember those?
We're speaking with Alexander Vindman, who retired from the U.S. Army at the rank of lieutenant colonel in 2020, following his experience in the events that led to President Trump's first impeachment. He reported his concerns about Trump's July 2019 phone call with the president of Ukraine to his superiors in the National Security Council and later testified before Congress in impeachment hearings. His new memoir is called Here, Right Matters, An American Story. You know, you write in the book that when you heard what the president said on that phone call, you said, I guess, to your brother, if this becomes public, the president is going to be impeached. But at the time, you didn't think it would and didn't necessarily hope that it would, right? What did you hope would happen?
Well, I was hoping that the process would work out. I mean, the process is there is no real clear process to address corruption or wrongdoing. If I were in the Department of Defense, I would be able to go to the chain of command or to the Inspector General, and then there would be an investigation. There is no Inspector General in the White House. There is a legal shop that was established for somewhat of a similar function after Iran-Contra and the Tower Report said that there needed to be some oversight and some legal reviews of actions to prevent kind of Oliver North type cowboy behavior. But that didn't work properly in this case. I didn't really recognize it at the time. I thought, like I said earlier, I thought that it would be sufficient to report it and let the counsel from the counselors guide the president back to what they're doing, what was the right policy.
The counsel meaning the National Security Council, you mean?
Right.
So you knew this testimony was coming. And what's interesting was that your name was not public. I mean, people in the know knew you were, and you would be, I believe, the first person to give Congress a firsthand account of the phone call, right? Nobody – there was the transcript, but you were the one who had actually heard it. So this was pretty interesting stuff. You were first going to testify behind closed doors, but I guess the procedure was that your opening statement would be released after you testified. And your lawyers, you had gotten some legal help, decided to leak it ahead of time to the New York Times. What was the idea there?
Well, I think there was a very cold calculation about not having my voice corrupted by either side. Certainly not having kind of if this were to remain behind closed doors. If you recall, there were congressmen coming out and saying this is what was said. To not have my not have somebody else speak on my behalf, but for my statement to speak for itself.
It would have just been competing spin from people who had an agenda rather than your own words. So there's this fascinating moment in the book where it's an evening and the New York Times has the story up with your statement in it. And you were busy going to your daughter's Girl Scout Halloween party when this broke. Just tell us about that evening.
Our phones blew up and turned out that basically every single major news outlet had picked up the story. And, I guess we quickly uncovered that the White House had already marshaled its forces very quickly and sent out attack talking points. And they were picked up by news media. Laura Ingraham was on there questioning my loyalties, my motivation, and all sorts of other stuff.
You know, let's just take a moment about the attacks by Fox News and others. I mean, one line of attack was he's from the Ukraine. He has a tie. His loyalty is in question. They also brought up the fact that when you were sent to, I believe it was the new President Zelensky's inauguration, you had some conversations with him. And one of the things you advised him was, you know, be careful about getting involved in American domestic politics. This all comes up on Fox News. I'm going to take the liberty of playing something from The Daily Show, Trevor Noah. There were a lot of the evening late-night TV hosts were talking about you. And what we'll hear is a piece here where Trevor Noah talks about the fact that your credibility was questioned. Then we'll hear from some Fox News personalities, including Laura Ingraham. And then he comes back. Let's just listen to this.
So if you're a Trump defender, how are you going to argue that this guy isn't trustworthy? Well, instead of focusing on the more than two decades he served America, you could focus on where he's really from.
He is from the Soviet Union. He emigrated here and has an affinity to the Ukrainian people.
Here we have a U.S. national security official who is advising Ukraine while working inside the White House, apparently against the president's interest. Isn't that kind of an interesting angle on this story?
I find that astounding. And, you know, some people might call that espionage.
No, your eyes aren't deceiving you. The new angle on Fox is that America can't trust this Purple Heart recipient because he moved here from Ukraine. Now, mind you, he was 3 years old when he came to the U.S. So he didn't move here. He was moved here by his parents, right? Because now they're making it seem like he was like a double agent for Ukraine. Like, what kind of baby spy thriller were you guys watching, huh? This little toddler was just out in these streets. Is that what you think? A three-year-old little Russian spy? You think his plan in Russia and like all in Ukraine, he was like, I will join U.S. military, earn trust, and then when time is right, I will make up story about quid pro quo for Mother Russia.
It's Trevor Noah on The Daily Show talking about our guest, Alexander Venman. I mean, it's funny stuff. This was not fun, was it, at the time?
Well, I'll tell you, if Trevor is listening to this thing, thank you, because my 8-year-old, fortunately, she was too young to really understand the personal attacks against me, the character assassinations. But she loved Baby Spy, and she memorized Baby Spy. And, you know, to this day, every now and then she'll bust out with a Baby Spy routine. So, you know, that was a bit of a bright side that, you know, my daughter could see daddy on TV and I get, you know, cool dad points or something like that. But no, definitely not. You know, with regards to my career, that was, in a lot of ways, that was also a key moment in whether I'd be able to continue on doing what I had been doing. A really pretty awesome career, frankly, to that point. And I thought that, you know, the organization that I had supported and served for decades was going to maybe, you know, in a tactful way, in a non-provocative, in a apolitical way, in a way that wouldn't harm the institution, still back me. But there was nothing. There was dead air.
We need to take another break here. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Alexander Venman, a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. His memoir about his experience in the events that led up to President Trump's first impeachment is Here, Right Matters, An American Story. We'll continue our conversation in just one moment. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Alexander Venman, a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. His new memoir about his experiences in the events that led up to the first impeachment of President Trump is Here, Right Matters, An American Story. When you came into the office the day after you testified to Congress in public, what was the reaction?
I didn't, frankly, know what to expect. My twin brother, he was right there rousing me out of bed. I was almost thinking about calling in a sick day. But he said, no, we're going to go in. You did everything right. You were great. So he pulled me, he dragged me out of bed, and we came in and we grabbed a cup of coffee and quickly, you know, maybe some folks called it showboating, but basically we put ourselves in a position where we could be filmed. And the whole idea was to show that we weren't, that I wasn't intimidated. And it was a message that, you know, that even though we're in the lion's den in certain regards, we will continue to do the right thing. Walking into the building itself, there were colleagues, the non-politicals coming out of departments and agencies that were coming over and saying, you did great. And I really appreciated that support from those folks.
You wrote about how once it was clear that you were going to do this, that you were being iced out by others in the National Security Council, left out of meetings, not taken on trips that would have been you certainly would have attended being the senior role that you had. You thought you'd get fired, I suppose, once president was acquitted.
I mean, I thought the axe might fall well before it did. I thought maybe I would have been out of there after the public testimony. I guess the president received counsel to not fire me at that moment because that could have affected the Senate trial. But for the months between when I reported that phone call, even before I testified, I was the target of retaliation. I was isolated and ostracized by the political class in the White House. Seen as not a reliable, political actor that would, be willing to do dirty work for the president. And as a result, I just didn't, I was pulled off of trips. I was still, in a lot of ways, as effective with the professional counterparts, those deputy assistant secretaries I mentioned earlier. They're all professionals. I could still do things there, but working up through the White House was an increasing challenge all the way through my departure.
So describe your dismissal. What actually happened when it occurred?
Well, so the Senate trial concluded on Wednesday. I thought there was an excellent chance I would be out of there on Thursday, but firing day is on Friday. So I should have known firing day is on Friday at the White House. And I was just waiting for somebody to let me know. I was still in the midst of planning a very, very important meeting at the assistant secretary level to try to continue to advance U.S. national security with regards to Ukraine and Belarus. And I was literally typing out the last set of instructions. I had already handed off everything I needed to another colleague of mine. And I was ready to go. Nothing in my hands. Everything was already out. I knew it was going to happen. And finished up the day sometime around 3 o'clock. Yeah.
Yeah. Just what exactly, who showed up? What happened?
The head of human resources, she came in with some of the security officers and said the White House has determined that my services are no longer necessary. The line that my twin brother had kind of drafted out when people were dismissed was being, kind of barked out at me. And then I was just asked to step away from my computer and escorted out.
When you were out of the National Security Council, you were still in the Army. And in fact, you were in line for a promotion to full colonel, which that has implications in salary and pension. And, there are interesting things you could have done in the Army. What happened?
Well, under normal circumstances, frankly, if I in a parallel dimension, if I had not reported this, I would have gone on to War College. I would have completing War College. I would have completed it this past month, actually. And I would have went off to a high value assignment, just like my career trajectory had placed me in, at almost every point doing something of critical importance to U.S. National security. But those doors had been closed. They had been closed by the character assassinations driven by the White House through proxies, including Fox News. There was an attack memo that was released by the White House that offered talking points, the same ones that you heard on Fox News and other right-wing media, that were the same ones that were parroted by Republican officials in the House and the Senate. And I took the temperature of the Department of Defense. I'd been taking it since my name became public, and at every point, looking for a lifeline to see if I would end up, you know, if I could salvage my career. I was told basically, you know, you'd flown too close to the sun. You had, you know, you're no longer going to be able to serve in that part of the world. You're not going to get another high value assignment. You know, you could ride out being a colonel, but you're not going to be able to do anything, you know, anything that you would find rewarding. So that wasn't enough for me, maybe even, because I waited till the very, very last minute to submit my retirement. And I was looking for something along the way, and nothing ever came. And I submitted my retirement and moved on, like my father and my ancestors before me, restarting again and looking for new opportunities.
You know, there's one other element of this, which is, you know, it's clear the Army wasn't going to give you a high profile and meaningful assignment. So that's one thing. On the other hand, you were on this promotions list. And as you tell the story, the White House was determined that you would not receive that promotion. The problem is, you know, there is a list and there is a procedure. And if I read this right, in order to keep you from getting your promotion, the administration, including the Defense Department, was willing to hold up this list, which included hundreds of other officers also due for promotions. Nobody would get them until you got out of the way. Is this right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's hundreds in the case of those that are already on the list and that are, you know, that are going to move forward and continue to prosper. But it's even a larger number of folks that just were waiting for a response to find out if they needed to retire, to move on. So there were many hundreds of folks that were who were waiting to understand the future. And I was, in a way, an obstacle to that. Many of those folks are my friends.
So when you retired, it removed the problem and the promotions went forward?
Yeah, well, I submitted my retirement on a Wednesday. And by Friday, I had my retirement orders. In the military, you start your retirement process a year out. It takes months to produce these orders. In my case, they produced them in 2 days. Unheard of. And then on that second day, on that Friday, they sent out the list. It's called pre-positioning it. So like this, on the subsequent week, beginning of that week, it would actually be announced. And it just unfolded that quickly. Right after I submitted my retirement, they approved it. And then me being no longer being an obstacle, it moved forward.
We should also note that you learned that there was a point where, while all this was going on, that there was a 6-point memo accusing you of misconduct, and the Defense Department looked into this and exonerated you. What was in the memo?
Well, it's all sorts of I frankly never had eyes on the memo, but I do recall some of the points being, you know, a toxic work environment, harassment. I don't even remember all the other stuff, but at one point it became so tenuous for, I guess, the department leadership, for Secretary Esper and Secretary of the Army McCarthy, that they were called in to the White House Chief of Staff's office, and Mark Meadows at the time, and were berated for keeping my name on a list when the White House wanted it off. That was in a lot of ways one of the kind of the last data points that I really needed to determine whether I could continue on. And I mentioned that I dropped my paperwork on the 8th of July. That was the very, very last day I could do it without incurring an obligation to stay in the military longer, in a world where I had no clue whether I was in good standing, or had pretty good idea that I wasn't in good standing, actually. But in a world where Trump still seemed like a viable second term president, and where I would have to live with a president that was vindictive. So all of these things came together, my path was clear.
So before all this happened, you know, you're a lieutenant colonel and you're a regional expert. You're involved in high level policy decisions and looks like you're going on to great things. As a result of all this, you're fired from the National Security Council. You're forced out of the Army, which had been your home for 20 years. You know, we began by playing that excerpt from your testimony in Congress, at which you said to your dad, "Dad, don't worry, I'll be fine," for telling the truth. Are you fine?
I am fine. It's been a long road. In a lot of ways, I'm still in the middle of trying to figure out what I want to do. But I could live with my actions. I've written this book, a book that's supposed to be a hopeful, kind of an affirmative view of doing the right thing. Not because there are inherent rewards. There are never inherent rewards for just simply doing the right thing. Actually, there are inherent rewards from doing the wrong thing. Usually that's what the payoff is, and that's why people do it. But for the right thing, it's being able to live with it. And I had a chance to communicate this to the American public that, you know, you could be fine for doing the right thing, and this is how you could be fine. These are the steps that were instrumental in my life to allowing me to navigate this. And I'm working on a doctorate at Johns Hopkins. I'm working at a think tank. I get to have conversations with people like yourself. So, I mean, we'll see. It's too early to say, but I think if I want to live in a world where hear right matters, I need to make it matter, and I'm doing everything I can to make it matter and encourage other people to do the same.
Well, Alexander Vindman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Alexander Vindman is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. His memoir about his experience in the events that led to President Trump's first impeachment is called Here, Right Matters, An American Story. Coming up, John Powers reviews Bullet Train, the new thriller from popular Japanese writer Kotaro Isaka. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Hotwire. Imagine a nice vacation. Is there a view of the parking lot? No. So don't book a cheap hotel. Book an expensive hotel for cheap on Hotwire. You can stay in a nicer hotel than you ever thought possible. Just select your city, neighborhood, and amenities, then get your hot rate. Better views, king-size beds, and freshly pressed waffle-woven robes await you. And also, actual waffles. Download the Hotwire app now and book beyond your wildest means. All bookings final.
The new thriller Bullet Train by the popular Japanese writer Kotaro Isaka tells the story of what happens when five assassins all get on board the same train. Our critic-at-large John Powers has read this international bestseller and says if you're looking for a good summer read, this book's for you.
Back in the 1960s, the late great film critic Pauline Kael wrote an influential essay called Trash, Art, and the Movies. In it, she championed the pleasure we take from movies with no artistic claims or pretensions. Among other things, Kael noted that for many people, loving trash actually creates an appetite for art. She could have been describing me. My lifelong love of books, movies, and TV was born of my boyhood thrill at disreputable pop culture. Hardy Boys novels, James Bond pictures, Spider-Man comics. They opened up my imagination. Although my standards have gotten higher as I've grown older, each time I go to the movies or pick up a novel, I still long for that same kind of teenage excitement. All of this is my roundabout way of praising a new book that did delight me in the old trashy way. It's a thriller called Bullet Train by the best-selling Japanese writer Kotaro Isaka. Simply translated by Sam Melissa for the Overlook Press, this is one novel that lives up to its title. Fueled by a seductively explosive premise, it's fast, deadly, and loads of fun. The action takes place aboard a high-speed Japanese bullet train, known as the Shinkansen, heading from Tokyo to the northern city of Morioka. There aren't many passengers, but they include no fewer than five hitmen. There's the recovering alcoholic Kimura, who aims to murder the person who put his young son into a coma. There's the goofy duo nicknamed Tangerine and Lemon, who've rescued a gangster's kidnapped son and are taking him back to dad, along with a suitcase full of cash. There's Nanao, known as Ladybug, who's the world's unluckiest assassin. Every assignment goes wrong. And finally, there's the Prince, a teenager who plays the innocent schoolboy, but is actually a sociopath. He likes to ask adults why it's wrong to kill people, then feel contempt for their answers. I hardly need to tell you that these five strangers on a train, plus some juicy side characters, are there with conflicting agendas. Within pages, they're going after each other like scorpions dropped into an empty sake bottle. There's a large subgenre of thrillers whose main action is set aboard moving vehicles. You know, the train in The Lady Vanishes, the bus in Speed, or the plane in Air Force One. it's easy to understand their popularity. Beyond offering an inherent sense of forward momentum, such enclosed locations impose limits on what the characters can do. And much of our enjoyment lies in seeing how wittily the story unfolds within these constraints. Isaka neatly deploys his locomotive setting, everything from the luggage racks and toilets to the train's occasional stops, to keep his characters and us guessing. One British critic compared Bullet Train to Quentin Tarantino and the Coen brothers, and the book does share some of their dark comic glee. Indeed, it's already being made into a Hollywood movie starring Brad Pitt. I recommend you read it first, for its light touch with violence will surely be coarsened on film. The novel has time to take us inside the characters, be it Kimura's shame at how his old-school father sees him, Lemon's habit of seeing everything in terms of the Thomas the Train universe, which drives his partner crazy, or the arrogant prince's learning to manipulate his schoolmates and teachers by studying the Rwandan genocide. By the final page, several characters have been killed, tiny details have had big consequences, and some folks turn out not to be what they seem. I wouldn't dream of telling you more, for this isn't one of those thrillers that's grappling with serious themes. The Shinkansen here isn't like the train in Snowpiercer, which is actually a microcosm of society. Isaka isn't trying to express some grand cultural idea. He wants to give us the irresponsible pleasure of sheer entertainment. And he does. At once outlandish and virtuoso, Bullet Train is like one of those dazzling balance beam routines that keep you hoping the gymnast will stick the landing.
John Powers reviewed Bullet Train by Kotaro Isaka. On tomorrow's show, Terry speaks with Kenan Thompson. Nominated for an Emmy for his performances on Saturday Night Live, he's been with the show longer than any cast member in SNL history. He also has an Emmy nomination for his leading role in the NBC sitcom Kenan. He plays a TV talk show host grieving the death of his wife and raising two children. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering help from Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, Kayla Lattimore, and Joel Wolfram. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.